From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're about the news, the information, and we promise we won't taser you, bro. I'm Luke Burbank. We'll explain what that means in a minute.
I'm going to hold you to that one, Burbank. I'm Allison Stewart. It is Tuesday, September 19th, 2007. It is the 21st anniversary of the colon hyphen parenthesis, also known as the smiley face emoticon, a love it or hate it part of our communication landscape.
Try to guess how I feel about it.
Hates it.
And I just passed a kidney stone. We're going to talk, speaking of kidney stones and health problems, Hillary Clinton, then and now, she has rolled out her new healthcare proposal, which is interesting for a number of reasons, including her very famous defeat with her healthcare proposal when her husband was president. We're going to compare the two.
And the O.J. Simpson case has really gone from kind of car wrecked cable TV to a very serious legal story. He is facing charges including kidnapping, 7 felonies, being held without bail. Wondering, is he being fairly treated?
Yeah, he could do life in prison, potentially.
And he's 60, so that's the rest of his life, literally.
Probably. Also, we're going to talk about the economy. The Fed, of course, is stepping in to try to stem some of the bleeding from the credit crisis. We're going to talk to somebody who's at the center of that story.
And we'll get today's top stories from our newscaster, Rachel Martin, in just a moment. But first, here's the BPP's big story.
University of Florida student Andrew Meyer was released from jail yesterday after being arrested at a speech by Senator John Kerry at the school on Monday. During the arrest, Meyer was tasered by police, an incident that was recorded on video and, of course, quickly posted on the internet. The video has now been viewed more than 500,000 times and has sparked debate over whether Meyer was a victim of police overreaction or just a troublemaker who kind of got what he deserved.
It all started when Meyer approached the microphone. Some say he barged to the front of the line to ask Senator Kerry a question. He began by citing a book that claims that Kerry actually won the 2004 election. That's when the campus police first attempted to restrain the 21-year-old.
You won in 2004. In fact, there were multiple reports on the day of the election of disenfranchisement of black voters in Florida and Ohio.
I'll ask my question. Thank you very much.
I'll ask my question. I'm going to preface it. He's been talking for 2 hours. I think I can have 2 minutes. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Before Kerry could answer the first question, Meyer continued. He asked why Kerry would not favor impeaching President Bush. That question included a sexually explicit reference to President Clinton's impeachment. He asked whether Kerry and Bush were members of the same secret society at Yale.
Also, were you a member of Skull and Bones from college and Bush? Were you in the same secret society as Bush? Were you in Skull and Bones? Thank you for cutting my mic. Thank you. Are you going to arrest me? Excuse me. What are you arresting me for?
You can hear the senator in the background saying he would answer the question. However, Meyer was physically removed from the room, but he did not go quietly. Finally, the campus officers threatened to taser him. Meyer asked that they not do that.
What did I do? Get off me!
Get
off me!
Get
off me! Get the off me, man! I didn't do anything! Don't tase me, bro! Don't tase me! I didn't do anything!
Don't tase me, bro, and the lexicon expands. This video has been burning up the interwebs. There's actually additional footage of Meyer outside the auditorium in handcuffs.
Everyone that was here today, please come to the police station. Ask them where I am, because they're going to try and kill me.
Now, there's a formal investigation into the case at this point.
Yeah, the president of the University of Florida said the incident was, quote, regretful. And he said 2 officers involved have been placed on leave pending an investigation.
Senator Kerry said, quote, I could have handled the situation without interruption. But Kerry also added, quote, the police must have had a reason to make their decision.
This guy, Andrew Meyer, he's a 21-year-old senior telecommunications major. He was charged with disturbing the peace and resisting an officer. He left jail yesterday. He hugged his dad and drove away in his lawyer's SUV. His lawyer said he appears to have been tasered after he'd been placed in handcuffs. The ACLU and Amnesty International have now come to Meyer's defense.
Now, Andrew Meyer does have a history as a prankster. He's already got a Facebook page that says, "Don't taser me, bro." He has a website that features videos of him standing in the street after the last Harry Potter book came out, holding a sign that says, "Harry dies." In another instance, he documents going into a bar, tries to pick up a man while he's dressed in drag. On his website, he writes, quote, "People should be pushing boundaries."
All right. Last but not least, and this is the BPP spin we like to put on things. We wondered, what does it actually feel like to be tasered? Is it actually as painful as it sounded in that last clip we heard? Okay, NPR's own Laura Sullivan did a piece on this a while back. She got herself tasered. Here's what that sounded like.
We're going to just give you a quick second, and then you can describe it afterwards. Ready? Here we go.
Ow! Ow!
For me, it was excruciatingly painful, like someone reached into my body to rip my muscles apart with a fork, and there was nothing I could do to stop it.
Wow. So more than just a pinprick, according to NPR's Laura Sullivan. But were the police justified? We're going to post the video on our blog at npr.org/Bryant Park. We want to hear what you think about it. Before that, though, let's get the rest of the news with our own Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. So the fallout from a decision by the Iraqi government to kick a U.S. security firm out of Iraq is now affecting diplomatic operations on the ground. Yesterday, the U.S. government put a ban on all land travel by State Department employees outside the Green Zone. Iraq's Interior Ministry Monday blamed the U.S. firm Blackwater USA for a shooting in western Baghdad. The Blackwater contractors were guarding U.S. State Department officials at the time. The company maintains their guards fired shots in self-defense after their convoy was attacked. But according to an initial review of the incident by the Iraqi government, Blackwater guards fired first, killing what the Iraqi government says were 20 Iraqis. Iraqi officials have backed away from statements made previously about kicking the company out of the country, but they insist those involved must be held accountable. And there was big news on Wall Street yesterday. The Fed cut interest rates for the first time in 4 years. And the cut did fabulous things for the stock market, creating what analysts called a thunderous rally. The central bank cut the interest rate by an unusually large 0.5 percentage point to 4.75. And no votes for D.C. residents. A bill that would have given District of Columbia residents their first ever member of Congress failed in the Senate yesterday, dashing D.C.'s hopes of finally getting full voting rights. The bill was just 3 votes short of the 60 needed to move the measure forward. The nation's capital has been denied voting rights in Congress since the year 1801. And for all of you who are sick of being unplugged from the digital universe on airplanes, Luke Burbank, get ready to log on in the sky. Alaska Airlines announced this week that it will be the first U.S. carrier to test a satellite-based online flight system in the next year. And if it works out, the airline may wire its entire fleet. Seattle-based Alaska plans to install broadband service on one Boeing 737 jet next spring. The service is designed to work over water and across international borders. Alaska, the nation's 9th largest carrier, says it's researching the price structure for the new service. That's the news. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
You know, when you go to a job interview and the question you always need to be ready for is, what's your biggest weakness?
Yeah, I hate that question because you basically, there's no right answer to that. So what you end up doing is trying to make your weakness a strength. Like, I just love to work so much. I work too hard sometimes.
Well, in a 2-year-long job interview we like to call the presidential race, Hillary Clinton is trying to ace that question. Healthcare? Yeah, I know something about healthcare. Well, the junior senator from New York unveiled her plan and political strategy this week. So her job answer went something like this. You know, I made a lot of mistakes back in 93 when my husband put me in charge of revamping the American healthcare system. I learned from my mistakes, and therefore I am uniquely qualified to tackle this issue this time around.
In a minute, we're going to talk with legendary journalist Carl Bernstein about Hillary Clinton's evolution as a politician. First, though, we thought we'd take a trip down memory lane and play Hillary and healthcare, then and now.
Back then in 93, Clinton's commission produced a 1,300-page plan which required all U.S. residents to have coverage. And even if you had coverage you liked, you'd have to change. Oh, let the attack ads begin. Remember those Harry and Louise ads?
Things are changing, and not all for the better. The government may force us to pick from a few health care plans designed by government bureaucrats.
Having choices we don't like is no choice at all.
If they choose,
we lose.
All right, but now Senator Clinton is casting her plan as gentle, incremental change. Here she is in Iowa this week.
This is not government run. There will be no new bureaucracies. You can keep the doctors you know and trust. You keep the insurance you have if you like it.
In 93, Clinton's plan would have required businesses to provide insurance for their employees with some help from payroll taxes, even small companies.
But now the talk is of shared responsibility by government, companies, and individuals. Big companies must provide coverage or pay a tax. Small businesses can get a tax credit to provide coverage. As for the individual, those who don't have insurance would be required to buy it, just like auto insurance.
Back then, there were 39 million uninsured. A majority of Americans said they favored government intervention to provide health care to all.
And today, there are 47 million Americans with no health insurance. And now a majority of Americans, still say they want universal coverage.
Then and now, Hillary Clinton and health care. Now, the rollout of candidate Clinton's health care program has been, well, politically deft. She gave interviews to influential writers, the New York Times and the Washington Post. She made appearances on Good Morning America, former Republican Congressman Joe Scarborough's cable show. It was a much different scene from the highly secretive creation of her 93 plan when she refused to identify any of the 500 consultants working on it. The healthcare issue gets an entire chapter in Carl Bernstein's book, A Woman in Charge, The Life of Hillary Rodham Clinton, out this year from Knopf. Carl Bernstein joins us today. Mr. Bernstein, good day to you.
How are you?
I'm doing just great. So chapter 11 in your book details then Mrs. Clinton's attempt to rewrite public policy. We'll go into the details in just a minute.
But I didn't realize it was chapter 11.
I know. Isn't that funny? Can you give me an overview answer on how did that experience shape the politician she's become today?
Well, I think your use of the word politician is the right one. Hillary Clinton has become a deft politician from someone who was tone-deaf, surprisingly, as a politician when she was first lady. And what my book really is a real biography that shows this evolution. And if you look at what's happened with her health care plan, as much of it is about packaging and the difference in the packaging this time around as it is in the substance. Both are different. But this time, the person presenting the plan and forming the plan is a far different individual than the one who was first lady. And one of the absolutely essential things to understand about Hillary Clinton is that she has always evolved. As someone told me on the day they were leaving the White House, Bill Clinton, emotionally, in many regards, is still the same guy who got off the boat after Oxford. You would never say that about Hillary Clinton. She's constantly evolving.
One of the things that's interesting that you write is she was quoted at one point saying, "Bill and I didn't come to Washington to play the game as usual." Was that an example of her being tone deaf?
In the larger context, yes. She came to Washington in 1992. After they had won the election, and basically set down a marker that they were going to do things different and not really be part of the Washington culture. And the Washington culture, as it were, those who were in powerful positions, both in the press, in the Congress, and in the lobbying community, took that marker and said to hell with it, essentially. And the Clintons were grievously damaged. You know, the most egregious mistakes of the Clinton presidency, in the most ambitious phase of the presidency, the first 2 years, were made by Hillary. You wouldn't see those same mistakes today, certainly not nearly so readily. And she doesn't come to this presidential race with a chip on her shoulder, which she really did. And today I think she acknowledges she did when they came to Washington in 1993. And there's another big difference. Bill Clinton won two terms as president, the first Democrat since Roosevelt to do that. So they prevailed in most regards. Yes, there was an impeachment, but nonetheless, they prevailed over their enemies in the long run, and here she is today running for president. So she's much less defensive than she was.
Let's take a listen to perhaps an example of this. I want to play for you an excerpt from an interview Senator Clinton did with NPR yesterday and get your thoughts. Melissa Block asked the senator whether it was an embarrassment to her campaign that she had to return $850,000 on campaign contributions gathered by convicted felon Norman Shue. Here is the senator's response.
Well, I think it was a rude awakening to all of us. I mean, not only in my campaign, but the dozens of campaigns going back to, I guess, 2003 and 4, who, you know, took contributions. None of us caught this, and we all ran searches. Every one of us does a vetting process, and my campaign certainly did it, and this did not turn up. And as soon as we found out, we took action.
How'd she do, Mr. Bernstein?
Oh, I guess about as well as can be expected. This is a bigger problem for her than the other candidates, partly because of the baggage that she does carry from the years in the White House when there were huge problems over fundraising. At the same time, she's not being disingenuous when she says, one, that the other campaigns did have the problem. They didn't have it to the extent that she did with Mr. Shue. But she's not being disingenuous when she talks, which she did not in that particular soundbite, about the fact that all of the campaigns are awful in their fundraising practices. She doesn't use quite that language.
That can be your next book for us. What do you think?
She might just be better at being awful or trolling in these awful waters than any of the other candidates. But, you know, the way we elect our candidates and the role of money, which has become predominant, is a disgrace.
I think we need you to write a book about that, Mr. Bernstein. Carl Bernstein, author of A Woman in Charge, The Life of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Thanks for spending some time with us this morning.
Good to be with you.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're always online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Let's take our daily stroll through the news we aren't sure you can use, but you might find a little interesting. It's called The Ramble.
All right, let's start in Snellville, Georgia, where police are investigating the death of a man who collapsed and died after he was headbutted. Now, this sounds like the sort of joke line, except for a guy is dead. And this other guy does have a pretty substantial physical disability. The guy who's dead was allegedly headbutted by an armless man in a fight. The fight was over a woman who was dating William Russell Redfern. He's the guy born without both of his arms. She'd previously, though, dated a guy named Charles Keith Tier. He was the man who died after being headbutted. Redfern was born with no right arm and only a short stump for his left arm. During the fight, Redfern kicked Tier, and then Tier punched Redfern, and then things kind of went downhill from there. Anyway, police are investigating whether to charge Redfern with murder. He and his girlfriend did call 911 immediately following the fight. They drove to the police station.
I have a potential act of violence, which is a little more ridiculous, frankly. There was a dog fight at Disney. If you haven't seen this video, you have to see it.
So
we'll link
good.
To it on our website. This video starts out with this little kid just running. He's running, and he's being chased at full speed by a grown man dressed up as Pluto. Okay, they do a couple laps around the square. It looks like the main street in Disneyland. And then this unidentified woman gets all up in Pluto's grill about the thing. The kid runs off. Then the woman yells at Pluto, and Pluto ends up falling off the curb to the ground. It's just we believe the little child, because the kid was running like he'd done something wrong, that yeah. maybe he...
Well, and the Pluto guy is pointing at the kid, and you can't quite tell what he's saying because he's wearing that mask, but even through the mask, you can tell that the person under the Pluto outfit is P.O.'d
yes.
at this kid.
We're guessing the kid probably kicked him in the planets.
Probably so.
That's my guess.
Keeping it in the SoCal area, a study released this week says that if you live in L.A. or L.A. County, you lose nearly 2 work weeks a year sitting in traffic. L.A. residents apparently spend around 72 hours a year stuck in traffic. Yeah, that's almost twice as many hours as the national average, which is at 39 hours spent in traffic. The report was released by the Texas Transportation Institute.
Do you know what? When I first went to L.A., I thought that all the fancy cars were really about conspicuous consumption and just being really kind of, I can afford a big car. But you spend so much time in your car, I understand why people try to make it like their living room.
But let me just say for the record, being a recent resident of Los Angeles, the deal is when you visit L.A., people often stay with some friend of a friend in Orange County. They go try to visit somebody else in North Hollywood.
Sure.
We're talking about the sort of two, you know, the bottom and the top end of L.A. And then they try to drive through the middle of town on a Friday at 7 o'clock.
Not so smart.
And then they come back to wherever they live and they go, that traffic is terrible. But the fact of the matter is, I had like a 15-minute commute in when I lived in L.A. because I, you know, lived in a neighborhood near town. It wasn't a fancy neighborhood. This isn't even necessarily about who can afford it. It's just saying, look, I want to live close to where I work. So there are ways around it. What I'm trying to say is my commute is longer in New York than it was in Los Angeles.
Oh, well, there's a river involved now, too.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
Okay.
All right. Hey, that's the ramble for today.
We're going to follow up on a story that led our show yesterday. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says he disputes Blackwater USA's version of events as to how a shooting in Baghdad went down on Sunday. The event left at least 11 Iraqis dead, although an official Iraqi report from the government puts that number at more like 20. And it says that Blackwater, which is a private security company hired to guard U.S. assets like the U.S. State Department there, the report says that Blackwater fired shots from a helicopter and shot at unarmed civilians.
Yeah, I think Blackwater is one of the only contractors with air power, right?
Right. That's part of why, as has been reported, they got this contract with the State Department. Now, Blackwater says that it was just defending itself from hostile fire. It acted legally. But this is kind of a big fight that seems to be brewing in Iraq. Rachel Martin is here with the latest. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, guys.
So things seem to have just gone to a whole other level of tension right now, right? I mean, what's the Prime Minister al-Maliki saying?
Well, as you stated, he's disputing Blackwater's version of events. And to just give a few more details on that, Blackwater says they were firing in self-defense. They were guarding some U.S. State Department employees. Their convoy was attacked, and they did what they do, which is they fired back to protect the assets that they were protecting. That is not what an initial report by the Iraqi Interior Ministry says. That report says, in fact, they fired on civilians unprovoked, that there wasn't an initial attack, and they actually fired on a car that a policeman was trying to slow down. That car didn't slow down, so according to the report, the Blackwater guards fired on the car, killed a couple and their baby, and at least 17 others, according to that report. And that's definitely increasing tensions. There are competing investigations going on, which is worth noting. The Iraqi government is going ahead with their investigation, and the State Department is doing their own inquiry. So there's definitely a tension.
Has anybody used the word cover-up? Because in listening to you describe it, that seems to be the elephant in the room on this story, that perhaps someone's trying to cover this up.
Well, I mean, no one's going to come out and explicitly say that, but these guys are really important to the security operations there. They are in charge of guarding all the top diplomats, Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador there, all his staff, anyone associated with the State Department. Those are civilian employees as well. And so if it happens that this license is actually revoked, and now the Iraqi government is stepping back saying, maybe we're not going to kick you completely out of the country, but they're doing a really extensive review of all the security contracts. And
that's what I was wondering about, because there are – this is such a key part of what goes on in Iraq for certainly the U.S. diplomats and stuff. If in fact, the Iraqi government prevailed and decided maybe even more broadly to sort of really – kind of rein in these private security firms, or even kick them out of the country, or maybe not let them, you know, do what they've been doing. Is that going to really mess up what the U.S. is trying to do over there?
Well, it already has. I mean, the U.S. government has now implemented a travel ban, a land travel ban. Employees of the State Department can't leave the green zone. This is a big deal. I mean, this is what top-level diplomats need to get out of the green zone, out of Baghdad, to assess what's going on. And granted, a lot of times they do that travel by helicopter, but this is also incredibly symbolic that these employees of the U.S. government's top-level folks are being sequestered in the green zone. This does not bode well for future diplomatic efforts there.
It's a lot of tension that seems to be just below the surface all the time between the U.S. and the Iraqi government in terms of the Iraqi government's autonomy, how much of it is the U.S. pulling strings.
Exactly.
And this cannot
exactly.
be helping that
and
situation.
And this is a really big moment, because now the Iraqi government is considering doing this big overhaul of the laws that were passed in 2003 by the U.S. occupation that basically said these guys operate with immunity. Now they're reconsidering, and it'll be a big test to see what kind of Iraqi autonomy really exists when push comes to shove.
Story is to be continued, certainly. Yeah. Rachel Martin, thanks for all the information.
You're welcome.
All right, so the O.J. Simpson case, it sounded like a joke at first, but it is getting seriously serious. Yesterday, prosecutors in Las Vegas charged Simpson and his accomplices with 10 felonies, including kidnapping and armed robbery. If convicted, O.J. could do life in prison.
Go ahead.
Prosecutors say he and his accomplices held two men in a hotel room at gunpoint. Simpson apparently believed the men had stolen memorabilia from him.
The story, you know, feels a little bit like a sideshow, but there are many, many legitimate legal questions here. Was O.J. Simpson set up by one of his supposed friends? Many people wonder, is his treatment extremely harsh, or exceptionally harsh, I should say? And if all the things he was trying to get back from, stolen from him, was he even really breaking the law?
Joining us to talk about it is Stuart Green. He's a professor of law at Louisiana State University. Professor Green, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Okay, so the first question that we were wondering about is the question of if, in fact, it looked like Mr. Simpson was set up. One of the men who accompanied him into this hotel room, a guy named Thomas Riccio, he was also a memorabilia dealer. Try to say that 10 times fast. He made a secret recording of this entire event, and he didn't give that tape to police. He actually sold it to a website, TMZ.com. Let's play a quick clip of tape. This is what another guy who was in the room, who's also been charged, his name's Walter Alexander. Here's what he told Good Morning America.
Well, because the whole thing was recorded, you know, Ricci was acting as if he was, you know, OJ's friend and was trying to do him a favor. And all of a sudden we find out he was recording the whole thing. And sounds like a setup to me.
So here's a question, Professor Green. If this was some kind of a setup, does that in any way help OJ potentially get off?
Well, sure. I mean, if OJ didn't know what was going down here, exactly what all of his colleagues were up to, then sure, he'd have a defense. But when people talk about a setup, I'm not sure exactly what they mean. A setup in the sense that someone was trying to catch OJ in the midst of a criminal act, that's no defense, that's for sure. My sense is that everyone who deals with O.J. now records, lots of people who deal with O.J. record what he says and what he does, because he's a slippery character.
Okay. For a while, it wasn't actually clear if there were firearms involved or not, but pretty immediately, O.J. was taken into custody. There were reports he was put in isolation. He's still in jail. We're going to find out, I think, today if he gets bail. Do you get the sense that a non-famous person, someone not named Orenthal James Simpson, would be treated in the same manner for this kind of allegation?
Well, there's a general presumption that people should be let out on bail. There's no expectation ordinarily that people will be held. But where there's a flight risk, then it's appropriate to hold a defendant without bail. In this case, of course, O.J. has a history of being a flight risk. So it all comes back to that
Bronco?
Well, sure.
But is the concern about someone being a flight risk, is it that they're going to actually escape? Because O.J. could – it seems quite improbable he could get on a plane and fly to Paris and no one would notice it, or fly to South America. On the other hand, it might cost a lot of money if he decided to pull another slow-moving white Bronco situation. I mean, what's the point – what's the concern with a flight risk?
Right. Well, certainly someone of O.J.'s notoriety fleeing the country, I think, is somewhat improbable, although stranger things have happened. But the idea that he might delay court proceedings by seeking refuge somewhere, and that we might have a repeat of that kind of performance of the slow-speed race over Los Angeles freeways, I think is something that is a legitimate concern. But certainly you're right. It'll be hard for O.J. to flee the country that easily.
So you don't think he's getting tougher treatment because of his background and because of all this, you know, suspicion about what happened in Los Angeles years previous with his ex-wife?
The way I would put it is that probably he's not receiving any special treatment that celebrities might ordinarily get. So depends on which way you look at it.
Something you wrote in the Boston Globe that really interested us yesterday afternoon was this question of if O.J. actually – if it turns out that this memorabilia – I really have to learn how to say that word.
You can say stuff.
Yeah.
We'll just say
if
stuff.
If this stuff that O.J. was allegedly trying to get back, if it was actually stolen from him, I mean, is there any sort of legal precedent for getting your stuff back, and are you allowed to take – extra extreme measures to do that, including, you know, being very rude to people and maybe even bringing along firearms?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. If ordinarily with a case of theft, if you have my stuff or my memorabilia in your house and I, say, wander into your house or your garage to recover it, then I have what's called a claim of right, and I have a pretty good defense that I haven't satisfied the requirements of theft, which are that you have an intent to deprive another of his property. If it was my property, then I by definition, had no intent to deprive you of your property. So that would be a good defense to a theft case. Now, robbery is a little bit different. Sometimes, traditionally, robbery was thought of as a subset of theft, meaning that you had to satisfy all the elements of theft, and in addition, you had to satisfy the use of the element which required use of violence or intimidation to effect the theft. That was the traditional definition of robbery. Now, there are some states now which define robbery somewhat differently, so that might not be a defense. I'm not sure what the law is in Nevada.
So basically, sneaking, you know, into someone's house and taking your stuff back in the dark of night is one thing. Barging in with a gun is a wholly different matter.
Well, sure. Right. Even though he might have a defense to robbery or theft, he's not going to have a defense to a charge of assault or battery. If you point a gun at someone and threaten him, it doesn't matter what your motive is, whether you're recovering your own property, you've still committed a crime. You've still placed him in fear of receiving a dangerous injury.
All right. Well, ever more twists and turns. One of the collectors who was in this hotel room who Mr. Simpson's crew allegedly pointed a gun at, this guy named Bruce Fromong, he had a heart attack on Monday. He's in critical condition in L.A.
Mm.
I was wondering, if he dies, could that change the charges against O.J.?
Well, I confess I hadn't heard that latest wrinkle. Yes, there's a doctrine called the felony murder doctrine, which says that if a person dies during the course of a felony, if a victim dies during the course of a felony, then that can be treated as a murder case if there's a causal relationship between the commission of the felony and the death, even if there's no intention to kill. So if you go into a bank, you point a gun at the bank teller has a heart attack as a result of being scared by the gun in his face, and the person dies, you can be charged with felony murder. So that's conceivably an additional charge if the victim were to die.
Well, Stuart Green, professor of law at Louisiana State University, thank you very much for coming on and taking us through some of these legal twists and turns.
Well, thanks for having me.
Who knew a colon hyphen parenthesis could change the world? Okay, maybe I'm overstating a little bit, but emoticons can provide a little bit of context to an otherwise dispassionate electronic mail correspondence.
if you can't remember a world without emoticons, then you must be a child of the 80s and the 90s, because guess what? The digital smiley face turns 25-year-old today, and one man claims to be the baby's daddy. The proud papa of the little fella is a Carnegie Mellon University computer science professor, Scott Fallman, who joins us on the phone. Hi, Professor Fallman.
Good morning.
Good morning. When exactly and under what circumstance did you first think, :, equals digital smiley?
Well, it was, September 19th, 1982. And here at Carnegie Mellon and a few other universities, we had email, we had links on what was called the ARPANET then. It became the Internet to other places. And we had what we called a bulletin board, similar to modern chat rooms or news groups. So people would post messages, and one of these was set aside for discussions about whatever, whatever people were interested in. It didn't have to be serious academic stuff. And people would put up messages that in many cases were meant to be sarcastic or humorous.
Mm-hmm.
And often there was someone who didn't get the joke, you know, who became genuinely angry. Out of maybe 100 people who read the message, you might get one or two of those.
So this was to help the humor impaired out there?
Well, yeah, and they're always with us. but in a two-way medium, then this guy would post something angry, and then six other people would post something mocking him, and then he'd get really angry. We had these flame wars, and after one minor such event, someone said somewhat ruefully, well, I guess we'll have to put an asterisk in the subject line for anything that's not meant to be taken seriously. And
that was your aha moment. I need to create something.
That was your semicolon dot parentheses moment.
That's what led to it. Several of us said, gee, we can do better than an asterisk. Let's see what's the funniest character on the keyboard. And I was thinking, we can do better still. Wouldn't it be great if we could make a little smiley face? But how do you do that on one line? So I'm looking at the keyboard and trying to figure that out. And there aren't many options. But if you turn your head sideways, then you can make this very nice little smiling face.
How do you feel about all the permutations that have come out of this? The idea that there are an asterisk in place of the parentheses might be a kiss, or the semicolon instead of the colon is a wink.
Well, it's interesting. Within about a month of my first post proposing just the smiling face and then turn it around and make the frowning face, we were seeing lists with maybe a dozen of these things, you know, a guy with glasses and stuff like that. So it happened very quickly, but it stayed within this little community of specialists for some time. We were the only ones who were linked together with email and could talk to each other. And then gradually, you can actually see it spreading as the Internet grew to new places. People would get email. Some of that email would be infected with the dreaded emoticon.
It's funny that you say infected, because you know there are people out there who get incredibly annoyed by these. Can you make the argument that they're worthwhile?
Well, I think there are a few things. You know, this is for informal communication. If you want to write a great piece of satire, of course, you're not going to put smiley faces in it. Half the joke is this guy serious or not? you know, if I'm just saying, you know, tossing off something very quick, this can prevent a lot of arguments. So that was the purpose. Some people, when they first see it, go nuts and use 100 of these in a message, and that's kind of annoying to everyone.
LOL!
But they settle down after a while. And the people who go just totally ballistic when they see these, well, I think they have more serious problems.
Well, Professor Scott Fallman told all you out there who don't like the emoticons, professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University, creator of the digital smiley face. Thanks for explaining the history to us, Professor.
My pleasure.
OMG, Allison. OMG, indeed.
Oh, the sarcasm is dripping off your microphone. Somebody get a handy wipe.
Okay, we're going to come up. We're going to talk about the mortgage crisis, which has been discussed a lot. But we're going to take a trip to kind of the capital of foreclosure USA, Stockton, California. We're going to talk to a real estate agent who works there.
You're listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Thank you.
Heyo, it's the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we're going to talk about the kind of financial doings with all the foreclosures and subprime loans and interest rates. We're all going to get kind of an explanation on this from Adam Davidson, NPR's financial correspondent extraordinaire. He's going to tell us what we actually need to know.
I think he's our guru.
He really is. He knows from money.
He is our economic guru.
First, though, let's hear about today's top stories from our guru of newscasting. It would be Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. Police in Cambodia have arrested the top surviving leader of the Khmer Rouge. That's the brutal Cambodian regime blamed for the deaths of more than a million people. Nguyen Chia helped the regime leader Pol Pot seize control of Cambodia's underground communist movement in the 1950s and 60s. He later became the group's chief political ideologue during its murderous rule in the 1970s, when its policies caused the deaths of 1.7 million people through hunger, disease, and execution. Nguyen Chia has denied any responsibility for the brutality. Chia has been charged with crimes against humanity and is expected to appear before a UN-backed genocide tribunal. And closer to home, the Fed has cut interest rates. The cut yesterday has breathed life into a languishing stock market. The central bank cut the interest rate by an unusually large 0.5 percentage point to 4.75. The move was an effort by the Fed to restore consumer confidence amidst all the turmoil caused in the housing and financial markets. And Wall Street responded in kind. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 200 points almost immediately and ended the day up at least 335 points or 2.51%. So what does this mean for you and your pocketbook? Stay tuned. More on this coming up next in the show. And the jury in the murder trial of music legend Phil Spector is deadlocked. Spector, 67, is charged with murdering actress Lana Clarkson in his mansion in suburban Los Angeles in February of 2003. The defense maintains that Clarkson was depressed and shot herself in the mouth either on purpose or by accident. The jury foreman told the judge that he saw little hope of resolving the impasse because jurors don't agree about the facts in the case. The jury voted four times before declaring a deadlock. The judge is now considering giving jurors the option of finding the record producer guilty of a lesser charge than second-degree murder in order to break the impasse. And 10 felonies and one gross misdemeanor, those are the charges O.J. Simpson now faces after getting arrested in an alleged armed robbery in Las Vegas last week. Simpson and three others are accused of breaking into a hotel room and taking sports memorabilia, but it's stuff Simpson says is his, and he was just trying to get it back. Simpson has also maintained that no guns were used in the self-styled sting operation. And the much-hyped musical showdown between Kanye West and 50 Cent has been settled once and for all. And the winner is...
I had a dream I could buy my way to heaven. When I awoke, I spent that on a necklace.
That's right, Kanye West's graduation album bested 50 Cent's album Curtis in first week sales. The final tally, 957,000 to 691,000 sales. Last night, West performs at GQ's 50th anniversary party, which turned into more of a coronation for the hip-hop king. In remarks to the crowd, he said, "To be a champion, you gotta take out a champion." The albums were released simultaneously last week in order to drum up the artist's rivalry and spur record sales. 50 Cent had said he'd retire from making solo albums if he failed to beat out West in first week sales. No word yet on if he intends to make good on that vow. And a quick sports update. In baseball pennant race action, the Yankees moved within 2.5 games of the Red Sox. The Phillies moved within 1.5 games of the Mets. The Brewers pulled into a tie with the Cubs. And the Diamondbacks remain 1 game up on the Padres.
Rachel, you said Kanye twice. Perfect.
I know. I intentionally put it in twice in the script, so I
that young man
two chances.
He needs to simmer down
a little bit.
Just simmer down, Kanye.
Little
He's feeling kind of cocky now.
Well, as Rachel talked about also in her newscast, the Fed lowered interest rates yesterday. It was a move largely motivated by all these home foreclosures in the U.S. The rate of foreclosure has now approaching something not seen since the Great Depression.
It's really, you know, you read about it and you really think about this is somebody's home.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
No longer. Don't have a house.
Right.
No more. All your finances.
And this is happening all over the country, although nowhere is the foreclosure rate higher than in Stockton, California, which is near Sacramento in the north part of the state. In Stockton, there's a neighborhood called Weston Ranch that has been especially hard hit. It's mostly Western Ranch is a 15-year-old subdivision populated by working-class families. With all this news about foreclosures, we've been wondering what happens to these neighborhoods, places like Western Ranch, when so many people lose their homes. And we've got on the line Roxanne May, a realtor with Western Ranch Realty. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for coming on so early there in Stockton.
Oh, no problem.
Can you paint a picture for us, Roxanne? What was Western Ranch like 3 years ago?
A very prosperous, attractive subdivision. Most of the houses are larger than average for, you know, our area, very well kept up. It was and it's a very well-planned area with the schools and shopping. It was a very lovely area.
And now what is it like to sort of drive down one of the big streets? What's it look like?
Well, I've heard people use the phrase war zone. I wouldn't quite say that bad. More like maybe a disaster area. Maybe in some of the neighborhoods, maybe every third house is abandoned, just sitting there empty with the lawns dead, trees dying, weeds 3 feet high. It's really demoralizing.
Oh, it sounds terribly depressing.
It is.
What does that do to the people that are still there to be living around all these shells of homes?
Well, I believe it's depressing to the homeowners that live there. Some of the houses, the vacant houses attract problems, vandalism. There's a problem not just in Western Ranch but throughout the county with vagrants moving into some of the abandoned houses and, living there temporarily. It depresses everybody's housing values. Now Western Ranch no longer is it, oh, you live in Western Ranch, what a lovely community. It's like, oh, you live in Western Ranch. It's totally turned the area around in a really bad way.
What's it like for you as a real estate agent when you try to take someone out to a house and half the houses on the street look like they're abandoned?
Well, everybody, the buyers that come into Western Ranch right now, they're aware of what's going on, and they're mainly looking for bargains, and there's a lot of bargains out there. They will ask, what's going on? Why are these lawns dead? What's going on? Where have all these people gone? It's difficult. It's very difficult.
Where have the people gone?
Oh, good question. A lot of them have rented. We have a property management division, and a lot of the clients that come in and rent houses through that division are people that are local people that are losing their houses to foreclosure and trying to continue to stay in the area because they want to keep their children in the same schools.
We're going to find out hopefully more about this later, but I don't exactly understand the economics, how it's better for the bank to have a house empty and with the windows getting broken than it is to have someone making even some form of a payment.
Neither do I, tell you the truth. I don't understand that facet of it at all.
Have you had people come to you and ask you for help trying to work this out just because you work in the real estate industry?
Oh, on almost a daily basis, we talk to people that are upside down on their houses and they just, they need to know what to do. There's not a lot of the real estate agent that we can do. We generally advise them to try to go back to their lender and go to the loss mitigation department to see if there's anything they can work out as far as a payment schedule or anything like that. And I've heard that some of the lenders are becoming very flexible on that and are trying to do everything they can. The banks really don't want to take the houses back. They're not in the real estate business.
Is there a pebble in the pond effect here? Because I'm guessing if you have a community where every third or second house is empty, that all the support services in the area, the grocery stores, the mini malls, they must be feeling the impact as well.
That doesn't seem to be going on too badly in our area. The one shopping mall in our area does draw in from a lot of the surrounding communities because it is on the south edge of Stockton, and there's not a lot of services out there. I don't really see that much problem for the support services.
Well, that's good news, at least.
Yeah.
Well, Roxanne, you sell real estate, and right now it's a tough time for people to come up with the money. Is this hurting your bottom line, and is your house in okay shape?
Oh, my house is fine. I have my mortgage paid off.
Oh, gosh. You're so ahead of the game.
Definitely hurt the income of the local real estate agents. A lot of them have left the business now. And there's a lot of us. There are people that have been in the business for 30 years that are telling me it's absolutely the worst they've ever seen it. And a lot of people are beginning to wonder, the really good long-term real estate, how much longer can we weather this as real estate agents? Because there's, just sales are down so drastically.
Hey, Roxanne, on some level, is it somewhat the fault of some of these people who got into these loans that they just couldn't afford?
I think there was a little bit of a greed factor going on in 04 and 05. I think people thought that they could just about buy anything, and before that adjustable rate went up, they could turn around and walk away with $100,000. And people were actually doing that in, like, 2002 and 2003. People, even 04, they were selling houses they'd picked up and walking away with, you know, $80,000, $100,000 profit after holding the house a couple of years. But more so, I really think that a lot of these complicated adjustable rate programs were not properly explained to the buyers. And I honestly think a number of lenders didn't actually understand the programs they were putting the buyers into, honestly. I mean, I'm not going to point the finger at anyone. I think there was some fraud. I think there was just a lot of there was a lot of feeling that this market was never going to top out.
Do you feel a little bit responsible for you're getting paid off of this whole thing.
You know, to tell you the truth, I did not work with buyers that were doing any of the I never favored any of those type of programs because I'm very conservative financially.
Well, hence having your home paid off.
Yes. My buyers, generally I worked with a lot of buyers. I worked with a lot of older people that were selling their homes in the Bay Area and then paying cash for houses in Stockton to come live closer to their children. I turned my buyers, I had a couple of very conservative loan agents that are long-term friends of mine that I would send my buyers to because I knew they wouldn't be put into any type of questionable program. So I actually, to my knowledge, nobody that I ever worked with is in any financial problems.
Well, Roxanne May from Weston Ranch Realty, thanks for coming on, and good luck with everything out there in Weston Ranch, okay?
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Roxanne got up early in California to call us. Really bad out there. Nevada and Florida joined California in having the highest foreclosure rates in the U.S. last month. It's according to Realty Tech. Georgia, Michigan, Texas, Indiana, Ohio, Arizona, and Colorado round out the top 10 places having the most trouble. That's a really wide swath of the country, diverse areas experiencing the problem. So we want to know what's driving the repossession of these homes. We're going to bring in NPR's international business and economics correspondent, Adam Davidson, who does double duty as the BPP economic guru. Hi, Adam.
Hey, guys.
So for the average person, this seems very sudden. You start reading all of these articles past 2 or 3 months that foreclosures are 100% higher than they were this time last year. How did things go so bad so quickly?
First off, I want to say the phone is going to keep ringing. The phone guy is coming today between 8 and 5, and
oh.
I said
he's going to come. And Adam, we've got to tell everyone you're at your house in your
I'm
fancy
at my
Brooklyn
house on my
studio.
Line, and I said yesterday he's going to come just as you introduced him.
And he has?
And he has, but that's okay. I'm going to ignore him.
What does he know about international economics? Can we interview him?
Yeah, let's see what he knows. I'm sorry.
Do you need to go to the front door and just tell him to hold on for a second? Because that's okay.
It'll take 10 minutes. No, I'm on a fourth floor walk up. So, hopefully he'll wait. Let me just say this.
Hey, Adam.
Answer your phone, Adam. We'll talk for a minute, really. Take care of it.
Take the call.
That was real. I thought she was really interesting. Her description of Stockton, California, that area sounded really spooky because, you know, you go through those neighborhoods and you think, like, what the heck happened
You know what
here?
It made me think of? And this is a very weird thought. It made me think of, like, I think it's Back to the Future 3 when somehow the time continuum gets messed up and Marty goes back to whatever the town is, but there's trash everywhere and the principal's, like, sitting on his front porch with a shotgun. I'm certainly overstating it there, but it just sounds like such a kind of sad thing to happen to. I mean, the American dream, right, is you work hard, you buy a house, and that place seems to be kind of where it's unraveling.
So, Adam, what happened that everything unraveled in the past year?
All right. Well, there's a few things. One thing I wanted to make, I mean, you guys are saying very sweet things about the American dream and owning a house and all of that. But those of us who are not at the risk of foreclosure, economically, we don't really care about those people.
I mean, we might care about those people.
Emotionally, we might. But economically, you know, it's not the housing industry altogether is 5% of the U.S. economy. The subprime component of it is less than a quarter of that. So, you know, it's like finding out that the sock industry is doing really badly. I mean, it's sad for those people, but it doesn't have a broader impact. What has a broader impact is what affects all of us. So what you're worried about, the whole global economy has had this system going for the last 5 years or so, which is U.S. consumers take out loans against their home equity cheap loans, 5%, 6%, and buy lots of stuff. They buy DVD players, they buy cars, they buy all this stuff. China makes it, Europe makes it, Japan makes it, and they get money from U.S. consumers. That's been the central growing energy of this wildly growing economy for the last 5 years. But it's all predicated on the idea that every U.S. homeowner, not just subprime homeowners, but every U.S. homeowner has access to quick and easy and cheap money. But what happens with the subprime thing is first a few people default, then a few more people default. At first, it's the people who probably never should have had a loan. It's like the whole market kind of went insane, just giving money to anybody, you know. And so there's people who were complete, like if we looked at that, we wouldn't have to be professional credit rating people. We would just know this
guy. I'm not giving that guy $100,000, right?
Yeah. But they were giving those guys $100,000. So now those guys are defaulting. But then more and more people are defaulting. We're still talking about a minority of homeowners. But it starts making banks really nervous about everybody who isn't a really solid bet. And so that means that, you know, the people who are pretty responsible can't get those home loans, can't buy the DVD player. Suddenly, you know, RCA, do they even exist anymore? Samsung,
somewhere
whatever.
Somewhere in Indianapolis?
I can't remember. But anyway, so... And that starts affecting the whole economy. People stop giving to NPR. You and I start losing money. People
now, that's
stop...
a problem. You're getting a little too close
to home.
Hey, before we run out of time here, I want to get to the Fed's response yesterday, lowering interest rates. Can you tell me how this is going to help in the short term and in the long term?
Sure. I mean, you know, people are saying, oh, for consumers, it means your credit card rate will be 0.5% lower, which is great. But I don't think anybody's like at Best Buy and says, oh, my credit card rate's 19.5 instead of 20. No one's thinking about that. What it means is banks have access to lots more money. This is basically the mechanism by which the U.S. government prices money effectively. So banks have access to a lot more money. So it makes them more likely to give money as loans to all those people who will now go out and buy DVD players, etc.
What about those who want to go out and buy homes?
It will make it a little easier, but on the margin, because the, you know, the banks are still going to be a little more cautious than they used to be. The problem is the long term. Is the Fed bailing out bad behavior, risky behavior, and is it telling banks, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, don't worry about messing up. Don't worry about giving money to a bunch of deadbeats. You're going to be fine because we're going to bail you out no matter what happens. That would be a major downside.
Adam Davidson,
what the Fed did yesterday.
NPR's international economics and business correspondent, and a man waiting on a phone. Go
Thank
deal with that, Adam.
Much.
All right, that's the BPP. Adam, that's live radio
that's
for you. If I get a studio at my house, I'm never coming in, by the way. That's the BPP. Thanks for joining us.
Our staff includes Ilya Maritz, MJ Davis, Dan Pashman, Wynn Rosenfeld, Carrie Toby, and Rachel Martin, of
our
course.
Senior producer, Matt Martinez. Our editor is Trisha McKinney.
Sharon Hoffman is our exec pro.
And I'm Luke Burbank.
I'm Allison Stewart. Do visit our blog at npr.org/Bryant Park. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.